Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing, which is a lot of things. And so you're going to want to avail yourself of all the resources. If you've never just checked them all out, the articles, the videos, the academies, all the stuff that 1517 does, go over to the store, look at all the books that we've published. Chad's not the only one at 1517 that has written books. I mean, obviously, I know every listener has all of Chad's books. That's a given, I'm sure, at this point. But there's other books out there by other people that you should check out as well. Chad, we are in 1 Kings chapter 5. We're going to get into some temple details. And we were just chatting before we started recording here that anytime like a tabernacle or a temple or anything is built, these are the moments where the scriptures decide they're going to give you a lot of details. Like sometimes there's things that you wish, and we've run into a lot of these things. Like I wish I had more details about this, this specific event, so I could understand it better. But the Bible just sort of gives you just a little bit and moves on. Not so with the building of tabernacles and temples.
Yeah, they're going to be like, let's give you several chapters worth of dimensions and materials and all the particular details of this this architecture. Yeah, we saw that big time back in Exodus.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you get to Mount Sinai and the narrative kind of stops because Moses is given chapter after chapter of all these details on how to build the tabernacle, what's supposed to be inside it, how big it is, etc. And then, you know, if you kind of work your way through that, then yeah, the episode of the golden calf. And then it turns around and says, now all those details that Moses was given, we're going to repeat them so you make sure and realize they were done. So that's the second half of the book of Exodus is kind of famous or infamous for that. Now, in 1 Kings, it's not going to be quite that lengthy. Chapter 5 is going to introduce us to some details about preparations for the building of the tabernacle. And then chapter 6 and 7 will tell us more about those details, and not just the temple, but also Solomon's palace and some other buildings as well. So it's going to be all about the temple for the next couple episodes. But first of all, chapter 5, we're going to be introduced to a guy that we've heard about before, but he's going to be a pretty big player in Solomon's reign, and his name is Hiram. And he is a Gentile. That's one of the things we have to keep in mind about Hiram, is that he is not an Israelite. He is a Gentile. He's the king of Tyre. Tyre and Sidon are often associated in the biblical narrative. So this is the king of Tyre, right there on the Mediterranean coast. And we're told that he sent servants to Solomon when he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father. We have this detail added. This is the reason he did it. He said, for Hiram always loved David. Kind of a fascinating detail there. If you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 5, we read that Hiram, same guy, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. So this is the first time that Hiram has been involved in the architecture of the city of Jerusalem and some of the buildings there. He sent his guys to help David build his palace. And as we'll see in 1 Kings 5, he's going to be involved in helping Solomon build not only the temple, but I guess a bigger house than his father David had. So Hiram, we're told, loved David. Probably not in the way that we hear that. So if I hear that so-and-so loves so-and-so, whether it's a guy loving another guy, or a guy loving a woman, or a woman loving a woman. Now, to our ears, we always attach typically attach a romantic sentiment to that, or at least a deeply emotional sentiment to that. It does mean that sometimes in the Bible, but not always. Sometimes when we're told that so-and-so loved so-and-so, what the Hebrew ahav, which is the verb that's used there, what the Hebrew is indicating is that there was a, what we might think of as a deep loyalty between these two, where love was seen primarily as not an emotion, but an action. So when we're told that Hiram loved David, that he had loyalty to him. He did things for David. Obviously, he helped build David's house. So that's probably what is indicated here. It's a, a fraternal loyalty between two kings, exemplified in, well, in this case, by Hiram making sure that David had a house built that was the kind of house that he wanted.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, one of the examples, probably the biggest example that we have in the Old Testament of two guys loving each other is David and Jonathan, right? So you have David loved Jonathan. That's probably different than this, where David and Jonathan love each other like brothers love each other. This seems like it's more of a they have a mutual admiration and respect for each other. They have an alliance. They have committed to each other. They're not like David and Jonathan where they're like doing everything together, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. But you know, it's the sort of thing where your kingdom's over there, my kingdom's over there, and I like what you're doing, and you like what I'm doing, and we've agreed to have peace and work together and all this kind of stuff. And you're like, yeah, I really like that king. This is working out great. That sort of thing, like admiration, respect, loyalty, commitment to one another.
Yeah, and it's going to be a mutually beneficial relationship, mm-hmm. as we'll see. I think when we get to the details, it seems as if Hiram almost benefited more from the relationship, from the materials that Solomon is going to provide to him. But of course, Solomon benefited greatly from Hiram as well. But anyway, this connection between the Sidonians or the Tyrrhenians, whatever you want to refer to them as, and the Israelites goes back a generation to David. Now it's going to be continued in the reign of his son Solomon. So Solomon sends word to Hiram, and here's what he said. You know that my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. So I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord said to my father, your son whom I set on your throne in your place shall build a house for my name. Now therefore command that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me, and my servants will join your servants, and I'll pay for your servants such wages as you set. And you know there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians, those lumberjacks from side. There's some pretty interesting stuff in this little letter, political letter that Solomon sends to Hiram. I guess the first thing that strikes me is I don't really know where Solomon gets this reason for David not building a house for the Lord his God, because that is not the reason that we read about in other parts of the scripture. Solomon says that he couldn't do it because David couldn't build a house for God because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him.
Yeah, so he's always at war. He's fighting a lot.
And he was at war. He just didn't have time.
He wanted to do it, but you know, when people are beating down the gates, you know, it's hard to get stuff built. Yeah, that's not what it is. David most certainly was like, I am going to build this house, and God was like, No,
David
you're not.
Wanted to build a house. Yeah. I mean, the closest we get to this reason that Solomon states is in 1 Chronicles 28, where we read that, this is David speaking, God said to me, you may not build a house for my name, for you are a man of war and have shed blood. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not the same as he's too busy fighting battles.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the idea that we were given is that David has shed too much blood to build the house.
Right. Right.
And yeah, he's a man of war. So that's that, which is obviously true. However, and I could be wrong about this, but I don't think that God didn't want David to build his home because David fought in some wars. I think it had more to do with he murdered Uriah, and he's that kind of man of blood.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with you. And in the bigger picture, the reason that David doesn't build a house, but the son of David builds a house, I mean, when you look at it in the big picture, it's pretty obvious why God was, yes, I mean, for whatever the particular historical reasons during the life of David and Solomon that God said no, well, those reasons really are the minor reasons. The major reason is the big narrative of Scripture. It's going to be the son of David who builds the kingdom, the house or God through him is going to build the kingdom, the house. And so that ultimately is the reason that David himself was not allowed to build a house, but God built a house for him, because this was all leading to the ministry of Christ, to the true son of David. But back to Solomon's reason, I suppose he's just being, you know, he's being a politician. He's saying he's not going to say the real reason. He's just going to use this as a kind of excuse, I suppose, for why it didn't happen. So that's the first thing that strikes me here. Another is this image that I suppose we've touched on it before, but it's worth pointing out. This language and imagery of until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. Just because, I think that's interesting simply because it comes up several times in the biblical story. The one that I think of is, one of the ones I think of is Psalm 8. Psalm 8 is the one, you know, how majestic is your name in all the earth, and talks about how, you know, who am I? When I consider the heavens, the work of your hands, the moon and the stars that you have made, you know, what is man that you're mindful of him? But then he goes on to say that God puts everything, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, all the animals, under his feet. Now, Psalm 8's talking about Adam, to be sure, but Hebrews chapter 2 quotes Psalm 8 in application to the last Adam, to Christ. So the picture here is of God creating Adam and then also sending the last Adam to be the king, the one who reigns, and everything, this is the exact language used, everything is under his feet. So the image of a king is the one who has under his feet that over which he reigns. But sometimes it's used in sort of a negative way, with the idea of the enemies literally being under your feet. And this is actually depicted in a lot of ancient Near Eastern iconography, where you'll have a king, a victorious king, and he's literally stepping on the neck of the people that he has just conquered. So this was a pretty widespread motif. And I wonder if this isn't all, well, not all, but connected to also way back in Genesis 3:15. So you've got the serpent, you've got the seed who is going to crush the head of the serpent.
Right.
So he's going to be victorious over his foe. And where, of course, is this serpent going to be? The head of the serpent is going to be under the feet of the one who conquers him. So in that way, it all traces back to Genesis 3:15 and the victory of the seed as he puts under his feet that arch enemy, death, Satan, sin, everything like that, in order that he might reign as King of Kings. So that imagery of under the soles of his feet has widespread implications when you look at it in kind of the big story of Scripture. And then a couple more things. Solomon says there is neither adversary nor misfortune. That's the end of verse 4. Literally, we would say that there is neither a Satan or Satan, nor is there a stroke of evil. In the Old Testament, most of the time when you have the noun or verb Satan used, it doesn't mean what we in the New Testament think of it. There's a couple of places in the Old Testament where Satan is a proper title,
right?
The Satan. But most of the time it's used just to refer to someone who's an adversary, someone who's accusing you, someone who stands against you. So, and this could even be used a couple of times in a positive way, where God is a Satan. He stands against those who are doing evil. So it does kind of have this generic meaning of, or adversary, or someone who's opposed to you. Now, this isn't completely true what Solomon says here, because later on in 1 Kings, we're going to hear about a guy named Rezon, R-E-Z-O-N, who is explicitly called a Satan to Solomon. So, and we're told he, that is Rezon, was a Satan, was an adversary of Israel all the days of Solomon. So it wasn't as if Solomon had, you know, all of his adversaries under control, didn't face anything. Nor was it like he had any misfortune or any strokes of evil. He's being a little bit idealistic, we might say. Everything is just so wonderful in my reign. It's just so beautiful, Hiram. You just wouldn't believe it.
Well, because of that. You're starting to get the impression that Solomon's a little bit like that. Like where
he's a little,
like,
bit, a little flowery, a little idealistic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't. If he talks about everything he's said so far, you know, whether it's he talks about how things were when his dad was king, like it sounds perfect. and how things are going right now. It's perfect. Everything, like, so when he's speaking, when he means to say good things to somebody, he says real good things.
It's like over the top.
Yeah, he's just, everything is incredible. Like, and this is the way that Solomon sort of is, that he's like an all-in kind of dude, you know? Like, where if he seems like he could get real high real easy. Like, if everything's, like, he's excitable, right? I mean, if things are going well, like, let's just build everything and everything's prospering. Like, he's into it, man. And if he's going to, you know, worship a false god, then he's going to go for it. And if he's going to have wives,
he's going to build a whole temple for the false god, yeah. Not just worship him, right?
Yeah, he's not, Solomon's not like a halfway kind of guy. I mean, he seems like, and we kind of talked about this, he seems like a passionate person.
You know what? I'm going to write a poem, a love poem, and it's going to be in the Bible. I'm going to write this romantic poem. It's going to be so good. It's going to be end up being metaphorical for Yahweh's love for his people. So,
yeah. Yeah. We saw this in the, you know, early on with Solomon loving God and loving high places. And he's just a lover of everything. And he, you know, and that's
a man of extremes.
Yeah, he's a man of extremes. So, like, if he decides to do some sinning, well, he's just gonna do that sinning. And but if he's gonna build God a temple, dang it, he's gonna build a temple.
Yeah. So that's definitely the impression we get of his personality. I guess the only other thing I'd point out in this little letter that he sends to Hiram is that the cedars of Lebanon, that really becomes a very common image you have throughout the scriptures. And I just learned today, maybe our listeners already knew this, but if you check out, I ask myself, hey, I wonder if, like, cedars are still important in Lebanon today. Well, evidently they are. Evidently the export of cedar wood is still a pretty big thing for Lebanon. And get this, their flag in the very middle of it has a huge green cedar tree.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah. I did not know.
All these millennia afterward, cedars are still connected to Lebanon.
And these guys have mastered the art of milling these particular trees.
Oh yeah, they know what they do. I mean, they are the ancient lumberjacks. They know exactly what they're doing.
Solomon says nobody can cut down cedars and turn them into usable lumber like you guys.
So he's puts the plan out there. Let's see how Hiram reacts to it. So verse 7, as soon as Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he rejoiced greatly. And I have a feeling he's rejoicing for more than one reason. He's also about to get very rich off of this little transaction here. So he's rejoicing greatly for more than one reason. But the first words out of his mouth are quite shocking, actually, when you think of who he is. I pointed out earlier that, he is a Gentile. He's not an Israelite. But what does he say? He says, blessed be Yahweh this day. Blessed be the Lord this day. So although he's from a non-Israelite city, non-Israelite king, he blesses the God of Israel by name. It doesn't say blessed be God, Elohim, blessed be Yahweh this day. So he's not the only one in scripture who is connected with Tyre and Sidon, who happens to bless or believe in, whatever language you want to use there, in the God of Israel. I've always thought it's interesting that in the Gospels, it's the woman from this same region, the woman from Tyre and Sidon, that whole Syrophoenician woman, as she's usually called in, was that Matthew 15, who comes to Jesus and begs him to heal her daughter. That's the one that Jesus rebuffs at first, as, you know, makes reference to, it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And she catches him in his own words, as Luther likes to say.
Yeah. Well, this is the reason that Jesus says Tyre and Sidon will stand in judgment of the Pharisees of the day, of the day, when he was walking around teaching and they were rejecting him. He said, yeah, at the judgment, Tyre and Sidon will be on my side.
Yeah, and it goes all the way back to Solomon, King David and Solomon's day. So here's Hiram, he's blessing Yahweh. And he says he's given to David a wise son to be over this great people.
It seems that maybe this king is, you know, it makes sense that he would be happy that David's son, if a king dies, and then his son is taken over, And you and the former king, you know, you had some agreements and you were working together and you got along and that was great. It's probably a relief to know that his son wants to continue that relationship and isn't some psycho, because you never know. I mean, you never know. You could have some especially the way that monarchies work. Like, these spoiled sons of kings sometimes get in, they decide, like, time to expand the kingdom, boys. And, like, who knows what kind of psychopath you're going to be dealing with. So he probably is rejoicing greatly, like, oh, good. Like, this is, so we're going to, this relationship's going to continue and we're going to be able to work together and stuff. You're not going to come over and be like, hey, how about you come serve me or some crazy thing like that, which is not, you know, wouldn't be like completely.
Not a remote possibility. Yeah,
no,
yeah,
that could easily happen.
It could easily happen. Yeah. And did happen a lot. So yeah, he's happy that Solomon ended up being a pretty good guy, pretty wise guy. So Hiram sends back to Solomon, says, I've heard the message that you have sent to me and we're all good. I'm ready to do what you desire in the matter of cedar and cypress timber. So he proposes, this is verse 9, he proposes that his servants are going to cut the timber and they're going to haul it down to the sea from Lebanon, and then they're going to make it into rafts.
They're going to float this timber down.
Yeah, it's going to float it down. You know, of course, this is not unusual at all. This is still the way that timber is moved from one location to another. It's going to make it into rafts, tie it together, just float it, basically. And it's going to go down by sea to the place you direct. Chronicles tells us this place is Joppa. So it just happens to be that same port city where our friend Jonah, that gracious and merciful prophet.
Yes.
That's where Jonah goes to. So Joppa was a port city. So they were just going to float it southward along the Mediterranean until they got to Joppa, take it out, and then however they, I'm assuming they used some kind of wagons, transported from that port city up into Jerusalem. So they'll break it up there, and then you can receive it. Now, here's where things take a little bit of a turn. Hiram says, and you shall meet my wishes by providing food for my household. Now, that wasn't part of the deal that Solomon proposed. Solomon's like, I'll pay you guys whatever wages you propose. When Hiram writes back, he's like, hey, I've got a better idea. How about, instead of that, you meet my wishes by providing food for my household? So a little bit of bargaining going on here. I mean, it's very political bargaining. He doesn't come right out and say, bad idea. Here's what I really want you to do.
Yeah, he doesn't mean also
yeah, that maneuvering.
This isn't like, hey, when we get there, could you have lunch ready? Hey, these guys would be hungry. You know, yeah. It's not like, you know, you're asking your friend to come over and help you move and to be like, don't worry, I'm going to order pizza. It's not like that. We're about to find out that he means like, why don't you give me a lot of food?
Yeah. Yeah, this food for my household. What does this consist of? Well, we'll see in verse 11. Hiram supplied Solomon with all the timber of cedar and cypress he desired, while Solomon gave to Hiram, and this is the part I referred to earlier where it seems like Hiram got a pretty good deal here. So 20,000 cores, that's C-O-R-S, that's an ancient measurement, 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his house.
Now,
20,000 cores of beaten oil.
A core, that's okay, so a core is like 6 bushels.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So 20,000... 6 bushels. Like, so that would be like, you know.
I've got it right here.
What do you guys
got the math?
This is, what is this? So this is like a lot of bushels, man.
This is 120,000 bushels. and the oil, 1,162,357 gallons of oil. That's a lot of wheat.
That's a lot.
And a lot of oil. Now, As is fairly common with biblical numbers, sometimes you don't know whether this is hyperbolic or literal. This seems hyperbolic to me. Now, I'm very ready to be corrected there, but it seems a little bit over the top.
A million gallons of oil?
That's a lot of oil. A lot of oil. Yeah. I mean, granted, Israel was rich in wheat and oil. I mean, they had the kind of ground that was perfect for that.
Yeah, but they're poor in factories.
Oil industry.
Okay. They're poor in factories.
Oil industry was a big deal. Of course, we're talking here not oil the way you see think of it, but olive oil. But yeah, it's a lot. That's a bunch.
That's a lot of oil before the Industrial Revolution, my friend. Like, that's a lot of oil to get the way that they had to get oil. That's a lot of oil to get. This ain't like this ain't like today, like how we get oil. This is a little bit more of an arduous process.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't run down to HEB or whatever your local grocery store is and pick up what they wanted.
Well, they didn't have machines like getting this, you know, extracting this oil, from whatever this oil was, it olive oil, whatever it is. It's hard to get olive oil back. I mean, like, they had a lot of it, but you got to, like,
you got to work for it.
You got to squeeze it out of the olives, man. And they didn't have, like, you had to do it.
Right. Yeah. This was backbreaking work. So whatever you do with those numbers, that was a lot. And it wasn't just a one-time deal. Solomon gave this to Hiram year by year. So it's a bunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Verse 12. The Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon. And the two of them made a treaty. Literally in Hebrew, they cut a covenant, which is what you did back then. So they had some sort of ceremony whereby they swore a treaty to each other. Then verse 13 through the rest of the chapter, verse 18 tells us about some of the numbers of the guys who were involved in this work. Solomon, King Solomon, drafted forced labor out of all Israel, and the draft numbered 30,000 men.
A little draft going on here.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to make of this. This isn't the only time this forced labor language is going to come up. The Hebrew mos, which is the word translated here as forced labor, it's sort of a umbrella term for, I was trying to think this morning of a good English word. I guess we might call it service, because in English, service can be fine. I mean, you can have a military service, you can have a service at a restaurant, but you can also have service can also have, depending on the context, kind of a negative, like almost a servitude connotation to it. And the Hebrew is like that as well, because mos is used in reference to what the Israelites were subjected to in Egypt. So they were forced into servitude, and certainly that was not an option for them. They didn't freely choose to do this. They were made to do it. It was servitude, slavery. But mos is sometimes also used in a just kind of a general, as a general word for service. So it's not completely obvious here as to how free of a decision this was on the part of the citizens of Solomon, but I certainly get the impression that this was, you know, this was expected, we might say. Well, expected service on their part.
It's probably like back, you know, when we had drafts, like my dad got drafted to the Vietnam War, and he did not have a choice whether or not he was going to do that. And then people now say, thank you for your service, which is a nice thing to do. And that's all great. But it wasn't like he had a choice.
He wanted to do that. That's the way that drafts work, right?
That's how drafts work. And it seems like this might be similar. You know, people might be like, hey, that was a really great thing you did when you guys were all working on the temple. And I'm sure that they're like, well, you know, didn't have much of a choice. I got drafted, but thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, as a free citizen, this is part of what must be done.
Yeah, it doesn't read as though Solomon just gathered up all the slaves or something. This seems like these are the people of Israel.
Yeah, these are people of Israel. We'll hear later on about some the residue of Canaanites still in the land that were actually forced into servitude by Solomon. But these seem to be just regular Israelites. He sent them to Lebanon. 10,000 a month in shifts. So one third of the guys would go there each month. They'd be in Lebanon a month, and then they'd come home and they'd be home for 2 months. So, you know, we can't interview them to find out if they really enjoyed this and thought this was a pretty good deal. Hey, I just work a month. I'm off for 2 months.
Were you getting paid? I don't know. Like,
you get something. Yeah. But, I don't know. I'm not sure, how that worked. Adoniram was the guy that was in charge of this. Verse 15 tells us that, Solomon also had 70,000 burden bearers. I guess those are probably the grunt workers, I suppose. That's certainly what it sounds like, burden bearers. All right, you guys, carry the timber, load the wagons, whatever needs to be done.
Sounds like some human mules is what that sounds like.
Pretty much. Yeah, you're doing the hardest labor. 80,000 stone cutters in the hill country. There's a lot of people involved in this. And this was besides the 3,300 chief officers who were over the work, who had charge of the people who carried on the work. So you've got of course, everything's set up here with overseers and regular workers, and you have some skilled workers, and you have some just kind of day laborers just doing the hardest work. At the king's command, they quarried out great costly stones in order to lay the foundation of the house with dressed stones. We'll hear more about that in just a minute. Chapter ends up by saying Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders and the men of Gebal, I'll talk more about that in a minute, the men of Gebal did the cutting and prepared the timber and stone to build the house. So we know who Hiram's builders are. Those are the guys of Sidon or Tyre. And of course, we know who Solomon's builders are. Well, who are the men of Gebal? These seem to be part of maybe what we might think of as a guild. We know that, so Gebal is about 20, 25 miles north of modern city of Beirut. And it's known today as Byblos. And it was actually known in the ancient times as Byblos too. So Gebal and Byblos are the same thing. Interestingly, for language geeks, so Byblos is the word from which we get our word Bible. And Byblos or Bublos in Greek means papyrus. So what would happen is Egyptian papyrus would be sent to Gebal or Byblos and then exported from there to the Greek colonies. And because of that, some people think that Gebal came to be known as Byblos because Byblos means parchment or, you know, the writing material. So it's connected anyway with the shipment of papyrus back in the day. But here it's called Gebal. And they we know from a couple of the parts of scripture that they were just known for being stonemasons. So presumably they were enlisted because a lot of stone was needed to build the temple. And that's the end of the chapter. That's what we know so far about the preparations. We're going to find out more as we work our way through the remainder of chapter 6 about how the temple was built. But the next chapter, chapter 6, starts out with an astonishing and very, very important verse that we need to stop and talk about for a minute. It's a time indication. So it says, in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. And then it goes on to tell us more about the house. Now, this, first of all, ought to strike us as kind of a strange thing to say, because there's nothing like this in the rest of the biblical narrative where something is dated from the Exodus itself. So in the 480th year after the people came out of the land of Egypt. So what's going on here? Well, I guess one of the things to point out, and I'm not going to spend any amount of time on this, but this is, for those of you who are interested in biblical chronology, this is kind of the go-to verse for dating the Exodus. There's a couple of different, there's two popular dates in scholarship for the Exodus. The traditional date is 1446 BC, and the way that is obtained is by taking this year, this fourth year Solomon's reign, which is 966 BC. So you add 480 to 966, and you come up with 1466. So that is the traditional date of the Exodus, which does work, but there's also some challenges to that, not just from outside the Bible, but even kind of figuring some of the dates within the biblical narrative to where that works. But traditionally, 1446 is the date of the Exodus. The other date that is actually subscribed to by most of scholarship is in the 13th century BC. So wherever you stand on that, you can check out any commentary on Exodus, and there'll probably be a multi-page discussion of those, the arguments pro and con for those dates. That's not really what I want to focus on. I think this is significant because it's an indication, I would argue, that it's really at this point where theologically anyway, the Exodus comes to its conclusion. I think that's the reason this particular time indicator is placed in there. And here's the reason I think that. So if you go back to the book of Exodus right after they crossed the Red Sea, so this is Exodus 15, you have the Song of the Sea. And the Song of the Sea, or the Song of Moses, goes through a poetic description of what happened when God conquered the Egyptians at the Red Sea. But when you get to verse 17 of Exodus 15, verse 17 of the Song of the Sea, here's what we read. You will, talking to God, you will bring them in, talking about his people, you will bring Israel in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. So when the Israelites cross the Red Sea and they sing this song at the sea, they really tell in a prophetic sort of way the coming history of Israel. They start there at the Red Sea, but the song ends with the house of God being built on God's own mountain, which of course is exactly now what is happening when Solomon builds the temple. So in a way, everything that was talked about in Exodus 15, climaxing in the building of the temple, the sanctuary on God's holy mountain, is now happening. And that's why I think that we have this time indicator here in 1 Kings 6:1, saying basically, hey, the Exodus, it started in Egypt and then went to the Red Sea and was sung about in this song and the temple, with the temple being built. Now that is finally happening. So we have kind of reach the true end of the Exodus when Solomon begins to build the temple.
It is an interesting thing that you get this sort of date thing. That's not a common thing. It's also nice for people who think we're moving really slow, just for them to realize that, you know, since the Exodus, we've covered 480 years. So, I mean, you know, yeah, we're not going that slow.
Right. And I was thinking this morning, this does fit actually very well with, as kind of a prototype in the ministry of Christ, because his ministry begins, well, first of all, when he's a kid, very young, where does he go? He goes to Egypt. He has to be whisked away, of course, when Herod tries to kill him. And then his ministry begins at the Jordan River and then into the wilderness to be tempted, which is exactly, of course, taking us back to the whole Exodus story, where they crossed the Jordan, they were in the wilderness. So the life of Jesus begins in Egypt, and then his ministry also begins with these very strong Exodus motifs. And then where does it end? Well, it ends in his resurrection. But what is his resurrection? In John 2, his resurrection is the real rebuilding of the temple. So yeah, his resurrection is the temple building. So in that way, this 480 years between the Exodus and the temple establishes itself as kind of the prototype for the ministry of Jesus, who begins in an Exodus and then ends with the temple being built. So for all those reasons, I think this is a pretty cool verse because of the theological overtones that it has. It's helpful sometimes kind of have that big picture in your mind as to why these things happen the way they do, and to keep in mind the connections between the major events in salvation history and how these are going to be used as the structure around which the ministry of Christ is going to be built.
Yeah, and it is just like us to not focus on any of those things and instead try to match some dates up. And
yeah, this is very true.
But we're not going to see Christ there. We're just going to try to count backwards.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's so easy with to kind of get, you know, in the weeds, get really into some of the details, and then when you get into those details, it's easy to miss out on the whole message.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why we do the podcast. That's why we do the podcast, because we try not to do that. All right, well, we're going to leave it right there. Next week, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty details of exactly the size of this particular house for the Lord, and we'll get into all that, but we have to do that next week. I'll see you then.
See you then.